on to our lesson, and you'll get to hear the rest of it later. But we've been doing this church history, basically this school year, I guess. And if you kind of think of it in three pieces, we had the first piece was the pre-Reformation church, basically from Pentecost up to the Reformation. And then the second piece, which was the biggest, what we put the most, time into was the Reformation, right? The Lutheran Reformation, we spent a few weeks looking at the non-Lutheran Reformation. We finished that up with the Counter-Reformation or the Catholic Reformation last week. Well, then now we're moving into the third and the final phase of this, which is the post-Reformation. Because, stuff's happened in the church since the Reformation, right? A lot of things. So now what we're going to be looking at the rest of the time in this class is post-Reformation. What happens after the Reformation, the history of that. So, of course, that's going to intersect with things going on in the world, just like all the other stuff has. But particularly looking at the church, and especially a lot of focus on the American church. Again, in the church, we'd be here for years. We studied everything in the history of churches. Would probably take till the day I died, to cover everything. But we're going to focus especially on, the American church, what's going on with that, because we've got into that period where, the colonization and all that's happened. We did talk a little bit about this, and we looked at kind of the post-Reformation church in Germany. Remember that? We spent a little bit of time on that, looking at what was called this Age of Orthodoxy, and then we talked a little bit about the Enlightenment, which we're going to talk about today, which started to influence the church in Germany. And remember then it was Prussia said, well, we're just going to lump all the Protestants together and all that. And then there was persecution of those who tried to stay, grounded in the scripture and the Lutheran confessions. And some of those people left and came to, came to America. So we did talk a little bit about that. Of some things, but mostly just in Germany. And again, things were happening outside of Germany, right, too. So we want to talk about that. So that's where we're going today. So this is on page 4 of your little packet. Good morning. Do y'all need something this morning? That's okay. All right. So come on in. So maybe in the right place, right? We looked at this map here of Europe post-Reformation to kind of wrap that up. And again, there's some movement back and forth, but this map is about 1600. And we said, okay, you've got Protestantism basically took root in northern and in Western Europe over to England. And then you've got some kind of mixed area there that's like into Bavaria and Bohemia and stuff in there. And then most of Eastern and Southern Europe remains Roman Catholic, right? And then you get out there and you still got the green, you got the Islamic powers occupying a good bit of territory that was once Christian, and some of it, like down towards Greece, Christians later reclaimed, but most of the, the North Africa and Turkey and all that is still Islamic. So that's kind of the state of the world there. And then if you go to the last page, there's a little chart here of basically, where did all this stuff come from, we can kind of look at that and see where we're at on that. Now, there's a bunch of these charts out there on the internet and in books and things like that. I really couldn't find one that I agreed with completely or I thought that was good, but this is probably the best one I could find. So just so you know, this is something somebody else created that was available freely and openly on the internet. But I would probably maybe draw it a little bit different, but I just have never drawn my own charts. That's what I need to do one day. Yeah, our biology professor, Emmanuel, said, I never could find a textbook that I really liked and thought was great, so I eventually just wrote my own. And that's what he used for the class. He eventually wrote, it was basically a packet of copies, back then, photocopies we had to buy from the bookstore. But it's like, I just, just wrote my own. So that's what happens sometimes, But you can see there, and again, depending on your perspective, the chart is going to vary because you see, okay, you start out with the early Christian church, right? You start out with the early Christian church, and not that everybody was agreeing on everything, just read the epistles, right? A lot of them are about addressing a lot of the problems in the church. But then from there, we kind of institutionalize into a lot of different things. And so if you go over to the left-hand side of your paper there, what do you have over there? You've got orthodoxy, right? Okay, so they're saying, okay, you got the early Christian, well, actually, they have the early Christian church, and then you get the Roman Catholic Church, the Bishop of Rome, and then they have, coming out of that, the Eastern Orthodox. Again, our Eastern Orthodox friends would not like that part of the chart, because what they would actually argue is that they are the early church. You know, they are the early church. Yeah, everybody else came out of them, basically, is what they would say. And I've heard them say that. I went to the Greek festival, went to the little presentation in the cathedral. You know, that's how it was presented, basically. Our church started on Pentecost, and, you know, everything else is, you know, has gone awry from that, you know. But they certainly would say they didn't come out of the Roman Catholic Church. Probably more accurately, you would have one line going right from the early church to the Eastern Orthodox Church and another line going to Rome, because you basically have kind of two power centers we talked about develop in the early church. You have Constantinople in the east, and then you have Rome in the west. So I would probably draw that as the line coming out of the early church. You would have a direct line going to Orthodoxy, then you'd have a direct line going to Rome as well. That's how I would draw it, but, you know, again, none of these charts is perfect. But then you've got in Orthodoxy, you have different kind of parts of Orthodoxy as well. You have the Oriental Orthodoxy, and you have, you know, then Orthodoxy of all the, like, the national churches, which are under the Orthodox umbrella. But there's basically two branches of Orthodoxy, okay, as well, okay, that come out of that. Like, you have, like, the Egyptian and Ethiopian are kind of like their own. They go, like, a little bit different direction than like, say, the Russian and the Greek. So, all right, so then we have the Roman Catholic Church, and we've got a line coming down here, and it's in, if I think you have the color copies. The ones I made today aren't color. I should have made color, but what do you have in red there? Lutheran, yeah. So you see, you know, the Reformation happens, and then look at all this stuff under there, right? Look at all this stuff that happens. So you've got Orthodoxy, and you've got Catholicism, but Protestants, man, we go wild, don't we, with all these different things. Like I said, once the Bible is out there for people to read, then we see all these different variances in how people are using it and interpreting it. But you can see the Lutherans, we come right out of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, as we've learned. Who else comes right out of the Roman Catholic Church? In the middle there, Anglicans. Remember, we talked about that, and we said Anglicans actually retain, kind of like Lutherans, maybe even more so, a lot of the traditions of the Western Church. Okay, they took that approach as well. So again, if you go to an Anglican church, somebody who's not a liturgical Christian, they would say this is like Catholic, you know, like they would say about Lutherans, maybe even more so. I mean, like I said, you were here. I wish you were here when we talked about the Anglicans, because you have experience, but you agree, right? And again, you know, there's going to be some variance, but I'm just saying in general, you know, Anglicans are, you know, they follow the liturgy of the Western Church, and it's generally even more leads toward like a high church kind of thing, you would say, even more than Lutherans in a lot of cases. Okay, again, Lutherans, you have a little bit more variance there. What else breaks away from the Catholic Church directly over here? All the way to the left, you have the what? Following your lines there. You have the Reformed, right? You have the Reformed, and that's who? Who's that, especially? That's going to be John Calvin, especially, right? Zwingli and Calvin are going to be over there. So all the way over on the right. So you have like kind of these three big things breaking out of the Catholic Church in the Reformation. You've got the Lutheran stream, you've got the Anglican stream, and then you've got the Reformed stream. Okay? All right? And then let's go to Lutheran. Of course, we know, we're going to talk about this later in the class, there's a bunch of different kinds of Lutherans today, right? But, you know, basically they're that doesn't really break that down into, they're still called Lutheran, okay? They're still called Lutheran, you know, the Lutheran groups, okay? Go all the way over to the right, to the Reformed. Remember, then you've got the Church of Scotland, you've got the Presbyterians, you got the Anabaptists, remember all those? Then under the Anabaptists, you get a bunch of things there that come out of them, in the Presbyterians. So you've got a good bit of stuff going on there. And again, this isn't complete, but it's giving you some of the main movements. But look at the Church of England, the green there in the middle. Wow. Wow. Okay, look at that. Look at all that stuff that comes basically out of that stream of the Reformation. So they really splintered here, right? I mean, we've already talked about some of these folks, didn't we? We talked about the Congregationalists. Those were the Puritans, right? Remember the Puritans? They were known as the Congregationalists. You've got the Baptist, the Episcopalians, which is the American branch of the Anglican Communion. And then look at the Methodists over there. A bunch of stuff comes out of the Methodists. We're going to talk about the Methodists a little bit if we get that far today. So a lot of these things you might have heard of here, okay? So eventually you're going to get like kind of the holiness churches, you're going to get the Pentecostal churches and the charismatics. But you see a lot of things going on there, okay, on the chart. And you might say, well, what's kind of the line? Where do these things come from? You can follow it back, you know, from bottom to top and see kind of where they come from. But again, even though Lutheran, you got kind of Lutheran, Anglican, and Reform, really, as we've learned, without the success of Luther, of what he was able to do, probably all this other stuff doesn't happen or it's on a much smaller scale. Okay, I mean, I don't see Henry VIII being quite that bold if Luther hadn't already been successful, right? Oh, Luther broke away from church, let's just do that, you know? But so I think the Lutheran obviously had a big impact on all these other things too, but you can see that there. So I thought this was kind of a neat little chart, maybe help you understand, you know, where do these things come from? And a lot of times things start as reform movements within something that's already existing, right? Remember the Puritans? Did the Puritans come out and say, let's jump ship from the Church of England and just do our own thing? No, what did they want to do in their name? They wanted to reform, to purify, in their view, the Church of England. But eventually, they're not able to do that, so they become kind of their own thing, don't they? Okay? We're going to see the same thing with the Methodists. Okay, we'll see the same thing with the holiness movement. All these things, they kind of start out as movements within an existing kind of theological structure, but what often happens is they become their own thing. Okay? They become their own thing. All right? So, any questions on that? Comments? Again, I wanted to point out that chart because we've kind of got part of the way through that. So I wanted to kind of see what have we looked at already in these last 25 weeks, and then kind of what's ahead, a few of these things. And again, we're not going to get into a lot of detail about all of those things, but if there's one that you want more information about, I can certainly provide that, or if I don't know, I can look it up, okay, for next week, okay? Anything with that?
I was just thinking, you know, what's the similarity? I guess Christ is the similarity with all, you know, when you think about the, the Muslim movement, and, you know, that was, Christ was just one of those guys. He wasn't God's son, but he was just a great prophet.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing that we can disagree on so many things and yet all believe in Christ.
Right. Yeah, all these groups here would say they believe in Christ. Okay, and without going through the whole list, I think I'm looking at some, most, if not all of them, would at least have the right Jesus and say that he's true God and true man. Okay, but then there's all differences with that. All or almost all of them are going to have some form of baptism in the Lord's Supper. I mean, it's going to vary greatly, the frequency and all that. One that is kind of interesting that I say that, I said almost all of them, the Salvation Army Church, which a lot of people don't even know it's a church, it's a denomination. They just think they're people that like help the homeless and all. But I mean, it's basically a denomination which started out as a reform movement in England. This guy named William Booth and his wife Catherine, they basically started this ministry to the downtrodden in London. They wanted to focus their efforts on that. But did you know their church, they do not have sacraments in the Salvation Army Church. Which is kind of interesting. They don't have baptism or the Lord's Supper. I don't think they're against that, like people practicing that completely, but they don't do that through their churches, which is kind of bizarre. I don't know why, but that's the case. But you know, but like in Athens, there's a Salvation Army Church down on Chase Street. They have a social services center over on Hawthorne Avenue, but they have, you know, like a congregation over there off of Chase Street in Athens. So they do have congregations. But again, they started in England. They went around the world. I've known a couple folks that were, you know, they call themselves Salvationists. Like we would be Lutherans. They would be called Salvationists. That's what they call themselves. I've known a couple over the years. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because they have like military rank and they're ministers. They wear like uniforms. It looks like a military uniform that they wear. But they do a lot of great social work, and they've been known as their, you know, like when they rate the charities of how they're using the money, they're always up there, like, and that the money that you give, such a large percentage of it. Now, nobody can beat the Gideons because it's 100%. Every penny you give to the Gideons goes to ministry, to scripture, I think. Candace here can tell us, but all their administrative costs are paid by the Gideons themselves, the dues and things that they pay. So I don't think anybody can beat that. But the Salvation Army is up there, like the general of the Salvation Army, who's like their, what we'd have a synodical president. I mean, his salary is pretty modest compared to most, like, nonprofits, you know, can you look at, I mean, so the Salvation Army is kind of an interesting group there, but this is like about the sacraments, but they come out of the holiness movement, as you can see there. But they're actually, you know, a denomination of churches, but they're most known for their social work. And in the old days, especially their bands, that's what they would do. They have a Salvation Army band. They'd go out on the street corner. Some of you might remember this, you know, and they would play music, and that's how they would attract people to hear the message. You know, that they would have this music. Oh, look, there's a band over here. People would come, and then, you know, they could preach to them and things like that. So anyway, any other questions? That was one that just popped up as I said, talked about the sacraments. But yeah, as Dick said, there's going to be a few things here that, you know, all or almost all these groups are going to be able to rally around. Okay? All right? All right. Let's go to the study guide then, page 4. And again, we may refer back to that, or you might want to refer back to it as we talk about some of these things. But let's start going through. Let's talk about the Enlightenment a little bit today. So we kind of have our transition here, again, from the Reformation that I've hopefully laid out here. Let's talk about the Enlightenment. Let's talk about the Enlightenment. I think we've mentioned this a couple times, but let's talk about what the Enlightenment was. Okay, Enlightenment, good or bad?
Must be good or enlightened.
You're enlightened. It sounds good, right? I mean, what's the alternative, you know, to it? Yeah. You want to be enlightened, or you want to be, I don't know, what would be the alternative? Ignorant, right? Or in the dark, you know, you're backward kind of thing. So enlightenment, based on just the name, it sounds pretty good, right? To become enlightened, you know, to know things. Now, I was kind of a trick question I threw out there, because I think there's some really good stuff in the Enlightenment. But then there's some really bad stuff, too. Okay, and again, it always comes back to the two kingdoms idea, okay? Almost always, you know, where we have the role of the state and we have the role of the church, right? And so I think in the left-hand kingdom of the state, the Enlightenment had a lot of good things to offer. But in the right-hand kingdom of the church, not so much, okay? Not so much. That was good for the church, okay? So just defining the Enlightenment there, you can see it was a philosophical movement. So this is philosophy, and there's, you know, different streams of it. Not all the Enlightenment guys are going to be thinking the same way. That's kind of the whole point. They were independent thinkers. There's not like an Enlightenment pope that says every Enlightenment thinker must think this. But it's a philosophical movement. It comes out of mostly where? What region of the world? Northern Europe. This is mostly a Northern Europe phenomenon. That's where, you know, a lot of these Enlightenment thinkers, you're going to see some from France, some from Germany, a lot of them from England. Okay? And what did the Enlightenment emphasize? Well, let's look at, there's some on the study guide. What's one of the things that it emphasized?
Logic, reason.
Logic.
Scientific method.
Okay?
Individual freedoms of people.
Yeah, individual freedom. Let's stop there. That'll give us enough to chew on for a little bit. Okay? Alright, so these are all hallmarks of the Enlightenment. Now, I'm looking at this list, traditionally, probably all of us anyway, growing up as Americans, are these all things we'd say that these are good things? Okay, this is, I guess you could say this is called, we're going to use these terms later, like modernism. Like if you want to talk about like what's kind of the dominant philosophy of a society, really the Enlightenment, you can see they're beginning in, say, the mid-1700s especially. This is like the modern way of thinking. It's called modernism. Now, kind of around the end of the Cold War, we move into a period called postmodernism, which where these things are not quite so valued. Okay, and I think now we're even moving past postmodern, because postmodernism really, we'll get into this much later, but just to compare, it basically says there isn't really absolute truth. Okay, so, you know, all four of us could believe something different that's contradictory, but it's still all could be true, because we believe it to be true, right? That's postmodernism, basically. Okay, but modernism is, okay, the truth is out there, but how do we figure out the truth? It's these things. Okay, so again, traditionally in America, these are all things we would say are good things, that values that we've grown up with. Well, where did all those things come from? Well, a lot of it was centered in the Enlightenment. Okay, because our country, as we're going to see, was greatly influenced by the Enlightenment. All right, our kind of found our period where we're kind of coming into our own as our own country, and we're going to see that, and some of you are probably aware of that. Okay, so anybody ever watched the old Star Trek show with Captain Kirk and Spock? That's who I'm thinking of here, Spock. Right? Because what was the thing on the Star Trek show? And honestly, my dad loves Star Trek, so I watched a lot. I've probably seen every episode of the old Star Trek. The new ones, I've like seen none of it. So I don't know, I don't know that. But I know the old Star Trek. Okay? And I know Dr. Spock and Scotty and all those guys. Okay? But what was the thing about Dr. Spock on Star Trek? Krista, you seem to be familiar with this.
Yeah, I was pretty young.
Yeah. It's the late 60s, right? Star Trek? Okay. So what was Dr. Spock all about? That's to be what?
He was logic.
Logic. Everything was logic. Because he was what, a Vulcan and something about that's like what their species of people did. Like everything had to be logical. Right?
Engineer today, I think.
Yeah, I guess. No, yeah, it's very much like that. But it's always a challenging illustration because I've never watched Star Trek. They have no idea what I'm talking about. But a lot of the plots of the show would revolve around, okay, something's happening, and Spock says we need to do this or we don't need to do this. Why? Captain, we don't need to do this, Captain. That's not logical. That's not logical. Or this is
logical. Nobody else on the ship had logic. He was kind of the only one.
Yeah, that was his dominant theme, okay? So maybe he was like the Enlightenment on steroids here, Dr. Spock. But the show kind of portrayed it as, are there limits to logic? Was Spock sometimes not making maybe the decision that we would say ethically we should make because he was limited by logic? So, I mean, he was pretty smart. He was usually doing the right thing. But the point is, logic and all of these things, but they have limits. Okay, because, not to turn this into the ethics class, but there are things you could do that are logical, but they may not be seen as morally good, and they certainly may not be scriptural. Okay? So, for example, you end up kind of like a utilitarianism here. Okay? If we know that, and I'm not saying Dr. Spock was advocating for this, another guy was advocating for this, but If we start to understand genetics and that genes are passed from the parents to the child, and there's, like, say, a family that this certain type of disability would be more likely in their children, logic, if you're just using logic, would say what? Let's eliminate those people or sterilize them so they can't reproduce. Okay? This was a lot of the idea of a time what the Nazis did. We know about the what they did to Jews, but they also put disabled people in the concentration camps so they couldn't reproduce. Even in American history, we had forced sterilization of certain groups of people. Okay? All right? This was again, not saying it's right or wrong in every case here, but that was a big impetus behind the rise of birth control in America, Margaret Sanger. We've got these undesirable people and they're reproducing like rabbits. We can't have that, basically, is basically what she said.
Yeah.
Okay? All right? So, but as Christians, we would say, well, okay, someone has Down syndrome, but Does that mean they're not valuable to God? Of course they're valuable to God, right? But again, using logic, and I think I shared this years ago, I was reading an article, I think it was like Iceland, they basically have no Down syndrome anymore. Yay, no, not yay, why? Because like every child they diagnose in utero with Down syndrome is eliminated through abortion, basically. Supposedly a country where almost everyone's Lutheran too, which is kind of sad, okay? So the point is, logic is important. Things, we said that's logical, right? And it's, I think God has given us logic, but we don't want to become Dr. Spock for a positive example, maybe Margaret Sanger for a bad example, okay? Where that's ruling everything. The ends kind of justifies the means because it's logical. Okay, there's a famine and we've only got so much food. Well, let's just kill off all the old people because they've lived a long time anyway. Just give the food to the young people. That's very logical. It's very logical, right? But is that ethical, Christian, and probably even in other religions? Not so much. Okay? All right? So logic is great, okay? But I think, we don't want to become too reliant on it. What about reason? Well, that kind of goes hand in hand. Reason is, how do we determine, kind of if something's right or wrong, or this is the path that we should take? Well, it's reasonable, right? We say this is reasonable. This is a reasonable thing. And again, is reason very useful? Sure. But does it have limits? Yes, it does. Okay, but these are the things the Enlightenment is emphasizing, is how do you determine what's good and bad, what path you should take, is reason and logic. And again, I'm not saying these guys were doing things like the later people, but I'm saying that's kind of undergirding those ideas. Once you make reason and logic the end all, well, then all kinds of things can happen. Okay, all kinds of things. So it's, what's the foundational thing of this? All right, what about the scientific method? Again, we all learned that in school, didn't we? They're still teaching it in school. What's the scientific method? How do we determine how something works?
We experiment.
Well, you come up with a hypothesis, right? And then you create an experiment to test that hypothesis. And then you look at the results of the experiment, and then you make a determination, well, your hypothesis was right or it was wrong. Okay, I think I outlined the basics of it. Okay, I know so a couple people know more about this than me, but that's the basics of it, right? And that's how things have worked for a long time. What do we do? You take an idea, you test it scientifically, and you see what you come up with. Okay, this is still basically how most sciences is done today. So that's what the Enlightenment guys would say. Well, that's how do we figure out how things work? We test it scientifically. Okay, we test it scientifically, and if the data shows this, it shows this. If it shows this, it shows that, and then you can do further experiments later on, and things may modify, but you use the scientific method. Again, these are very common ideas, okay, that we have. All right, Krista said individual freedom. We get on there. Okay, so the Enlightenment folks said the individual is important, not just the group. The individual is important, and an individual should have certain freedoms, okay? That there are what this thing called, especially from John Locke, writes about this, natural rights, that by being a person, you have certain individual rights, you have certain freedoms, natural rights, right? Connect the dots here. See, I said this has a lot to do with the infancy of the American experiment, where we're saying we don't want to be British anymore, we want to be Americans now. And that happened over a period of time. But does that sound familiar to anything? Inalienable rights. In the pursuit of happiness. Declaration of Independence. Okay? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Okay? So, we have that in our document, and again, this is teaching kids history and government and stuff like that. If you ask most people, especially younger people, even some older people, say, "Okay, we have rights as Americans. Where do those rights come from?" You know what most people are going to say, from my experience, and most kids, Where do the rights that we have come from?
Government.
Government. They come from government. Okay? Is that right or wrong?
Wrong.
Wrong. Is that actually a very different view than the other?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if your rights come from government, what can happen?
Government can change it.
They can, yeah. The government can take those rights away. They're limited. They're limited in that, you know, basically the idea you have this government, and if they're nice enough, they'll give you rights. You know, they will decide what rights you have. But according to our foundational documents, and according to these Enlightenment guys, governments exist, I mean, rights exist independent of governments. Because remember, this is a time mostly of totalitarian governments. This is pretty radical, right? This is a time the idea of divine right of kings, you know, and all this. So the, you know, they're saying, well, the government, our rights don't come from the government. They come from being people, which you take that a step further. What we write in our founding documents, where do we get those then? They are endowed by our Creator. Now, notice they didn't say the Trinitarian God. They didn't say Jesus. But they at least acknowledged the Creator, okay? And that's very Enlightenment, too. Because, not getting too far ahead, did most of these Enlightenment guys, did they reject God completely? No, they did not. There were a few that basically said, but most of them, did most of them ascribe to all the Orthodox beliefs of Christianity? No. So even the use of that word creator might be seen as, I don't know, conservative today. They acknowledge God. But at that time, that was kind of, you know, they weren't specifically saying the God of the Bible. They were saying the creator. That may have been implied, but I think that use of the word is important because it's showing some of this Enlightenment influence. But so as Americans, according to our foundational document, what do we believe? Our rights don't come from government. They come from God. Okay? That's what they said. Okay? And that's a very different concept. If we believed our rights came from government, would we have ever rebelled against Britain? No. Because we'd say Britain is in charge. What they say goes. We might not like it. But what we said is no. We have rights that are given to us by God, and no government can take those away. And what does the Declaration go on to say? Well, when these rights are violated, it's the duty of the people to basically change the government. Now, fortunately, we have elections today, but back then Britain wasn't letting them vote, so they felt we had to revolt. Okay? So you see how this whole Enlightenment thing is really impacting us today? But again, I think that's something we need to make sure we're teaching to younger generations, that our rights do not come from government. Okay, our rights are endowed by our Creator. Okay, because it's two very different starting points there. Okay, two very different starting points. Go ahead.
Well, I just thought that statement is contrary to evolution.
Okay.
Because
right.
Because if evolution was believed, then there is no Creator.
Right, exactly. And we haven't got to it yet, but are they really dealing with evolution yet? No.
Not really.
Yeah. Darwin is not even a twinkle in his parents' eyes at this point. Okay, Darwin's not around. Now, you do see some of them start at this time even like questioning the age of the earth and things like that as geology is developing. But yeah, you don't really see, there's nobody running around Europe or colonial America saying that we came from apes. You know, that hasn't dropped yet. You know, Satan hasn't dropped that bomb yet. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, that we probably wouldn't write that today, would we? Because, oh, creator. I think today would be very humanistic, which humanism, you know, kind of flows out of this, comes along later, where humanism is like really completely secular, you know, without the acknowledgement of a divine being. So my point is, they're moving away, as we're going to see, from some of the Orthodox doctrines of Christianity, but there's still this idea that there's a creator God. There is a creator God, which makes sense because it's completely obvious, you know, the creation is evidence that there's a creator. If we're here, if stuff's here, it had to get here somehow. And, of course, that's where, later on, evolutionary theory says, you know, well, they try to explain that. So they still can't explain the genesis, if you will, of all of it. You know, where did the first particle come that supposedly exploded and created all this? Where did that come from? Well, aliens brought it from another planet. Well, where did those aliens come from? Well, they came from another planet. You know, they can't answer that question, okay? You know, again, maybe this is a rabbit trail, but ultimately it comes down to you believe God created everything, or you believe nothing created everything. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Because even if you subscribe to all of the, you know, theory, which is constantly changing, the ages, even if you ascribe to all, you're going back to the Big Bang, well, where did it come from? Okay, where did the matter come from? Okay, you can't answer that question. Okay, so really I would argue there's faith in both positions. You know, as a Christian, I would say, well, God created it. Well, how can, you know, where did God come from? Why don't you know, you're saying, well, where did your matter come from? Okay, you know, does it just magically appear one day? I mean, what happened? So ultimately, it comes down to, you know, either God or everything. But that's maybe a rabbit trail. But since Dick brought that up. But this idea of natural rights from our Creator, this is very much ingrained. And Jefferson is the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, right? Now, there's a committee of five guys, but, you know, Jefferson basically, it's kind of like, I say it's like, I tell my kids, it's like, you know, a group project in school. The teacher puts you in groups, and then what does the group do? They say, one person, do all the work. It's kind of self-defeating. Who's the best writer here? Tom, you write this thing. And, of course, then once they got it, they made their edits, John Adams and the other guys on the committee made the edits. But Jefferson's the primary author of it. Now, one of the reasons they chose Jefferson, because he was a great writer, but also he was very well read. Guess what Jefferson had read? He had read all these Enlightenment guys. I mean, Jefferson had an incredible collection of books at a time when people had maybe one or two books. They probably had the Bible, maybe Poor Richard's Almanac. That was it in their house. Jefferson had read all these Enlightenment guys. I mean, great stories. You know, Washington, D.C. was burned by the British in the War of 1812. And then included our, the collection of books and stuff the government had begun to collect. The Library of Congress, Thomas Jefferson donates his book collection, basically 3,000 books to start the Library of Congress. So he had like thousands of books. That's where it started from Jefferson. Okay? So the point is, Jefferson, a lot of these ideas that he had read with the Enlightenment, they're making their way into this. Even our Constitution, what kind of government does our Constitution set up? So I guess we're getting a civics lesson today too, but what kind of government does our Constitution set up? It's a federal republic, and is the government's power limited? Yeah. Okay, even before you get to the Bill of Rights, which said these are the rights that we have, there's three branches of government, right? Why did they do that? Well, that came from one of these Enlightenment guys, it was Montesquieu. And Montesquieu said, you know how you keep the government from becoming overbearing? You divide it into pieces. How do you make something weaker? You divide it, right? So the drafters of the Constitution said, well, we need to have three branches. You're going to have one branch that's going to make the laws, another branch that's going to enforce the laws, another branch that's going to interpret the law. That way you won't have one leader who's all-powerful. Okay? You won't, you know, again, I know we've had all these debates of maybe getting out of whack in different branches and all that, but that's the idea. So the Constitution lays out certain things the government can do and certain things they can't do, even if a majority wants them. Okay? So all of this is very Enlightenment. Okay? Very Enlightenment. All right. So these are all things that are promoted by the Enlightenment guys, and as we've seen, they've really influenced even our own country up to today. Okay? Anything else with that? All right. Well, that's all great, right? Enlightenment. Yeah, it sounds good. Well, but let's talk a little bit about theology here, though. So I think with the economy, like guys like Adam Smith, basically he's the founder of free enterprise, because did they have free enterprise in colonial America? Was that the idea of the colonies? No. It was mercantilism. That was the dominant theory. But the Enlightenment guys, Adam Smith writes The Wealth of Nations, I think it was published the same year as the Declaration of Independence, maybe, that said, you know, we have to have free markets. We have to have competition. Okay, again, this idea of freedom. Okay, freedom. Rather than, why did Britain want the colonies, and what was the big thing about it? They passed these things called the Navigation Acts, which said the colonies can only trade with Britain, with England. Now, they didn't always enforce them, and when they started enforcing them, it took people off, and the rest is history. After the French and Indian War, they needed money, so we got to start enforcing this stuff, you know, because we're broke. We defeated the French, but now we're broke. So the point is that That was not free market. If you were, let's say you had a field of timber in America and you cut it down, you couldn't just sell it to the Dutch or the French if they're going to give you a better price. By law, you had to sell it to the British. That's not economic freedom. That's mercantilism. Okay, because it existed to benefit the mother country economically. But the Enlightenment guys come along and say, no, that's not how it's supposed to work. I should be free to choose what I want to produce and who I want to sell it to. Very radical for that time. Very American, right? Okay, very American, at least traditionally, okay? So, but let's look at the leaders of the Enlightenment, some of the negative here. What is their view of religion, of traditional Christian beliefs? The organized church, not so positive, not so positive. Okay, so you can see that there. I think it's in italics. Many of its leaders were not supportive, or they were even hostile to Orthodox Christianity. When I was working on my master's, I had to read some of these guys, Rousseau and Voltaire. Oh, man, this is kind of some interesting reading. But they kind of had some interesting ideas, and they certainly were not friendly to Orthodox Christianity, either of those guys. Okay, so some of them more so than others, but they saw this as that was kind of part of the old system that was stood in opposition. They saw Orthodox Christianity as not reasonable, not logical, not scientific, and not valuing human rights. Okay, so they said this has to change. Okay, so they were seen as rebels in that sense. What about the Bible?
It wasn't inerrant.
Yes, that was their view. So did most of them, again, some of them were more radical than others, but did most of them reject the Bible outright? No. But what they would say, well, it may not be inerrant. Okay, there might be things in there that are just allegorical, or later we'll see this idea, well, that worked its way in. So they still kind of had a religious veneer, most of them, but they questioned the Bible. And why would they question the inerrancy and the kind of final authority thing of the Bible? Like, that's the Reformation, right? The Reformation is the Bible is it. The Bible is the Word of God. Everything has to be based on the Bible. But now we've got to a point where there's these Enlightenment guys are saying, no, why not? Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, I would argue that the Bible does teach about individual freedom, but it also teaches about community. There's that balance there, okay? Because some have gone the other way, so, made Christianity kind of completely individualistic. No, it's a community, faith lived out in community, obviously. Okay, but so where the Reformers would say the Bible is it, the Bible, by Scripture alone, that's how we know everything to be true or not true. The Enlightenment said, no, it's by these three things here that we test everything. Okay, and as we've said many times in this class, is everything in the Bible reasonable? No. Is everything in the Bible logical? Does everything in the Bible follow the scientific method? No. No, a lot of things do, but do they all know? Okay? So they would say, well, it can't be the Bible. The Bible maybe has some good morals and Jesus did some cool things and stuff, but the Bible can't be where we're getting our, we have to do these things to determine what's right and wrong and what's true and false, rather than the Word of God. Okay, so that's a major problem. Okay, so again, I'm thinking left-hand kingdom, a lot of good stuff the Enlightenment gave us. Thanks be to God. But then on the right-hand kingdom stuff, this is starting to undercut the church. Okay? Because they're really doubting the foundation of it. And going along with that, when you start to question the Bible, what else do you start to question? Which is what the Bible is really all about, Jesus. Okay, so some of these Enlightenment guys would say, what about Jesus? He's a nice guy. He taught some pretty interesting and profound things. He was a man of the people. Okay, but what about the literal Son of God, God and man at the same time? Not so much. A lot of them question that. Okay, those two things really go hand in hand. When you start questioning the Bible and doubting the Bible, you're going to get a skewed version of Jesus. Okay? I mean, it happens every time. This happens every time. I can't think of an example when that hasn't happened. Okay? So, what about, this is a big part of the Bible, miracles.
Can't happen.
Yeah, really, And again, we're painting with a broad brush here because there's a lot of enlightenment. But generally, they would question miracles. The miracles of the Bible. Did those really happen? They would say no. Yeah, they say, because why? That, well, okay, can we test the, I don't know, the feeding of the 5,000 where five loaves of bread and two fish feed 5,000, really more than that, because that's just the men. Is that reasonable? No. Is that logical? No. Can we do a scientific experiment and show how he did it? No. Now, they weren't back then, but even if they could, it's a miracle. So the miracles, the supernatural nature of the Bible, the supernatural things are beginning to be questioned. So this isn't just something that's happened in the last, you know, generation, okay, or even the last 100 years. The tentacles of this go way back, all right? That's what it says in the notes there. Miracles could not happen, they argued, because they were against the natural laws of science. They defied reason. All right, but what about God, though? I think I've already answered this. Wasn't the Enlightenment, again, as a general rule, there were a few that rejected God completely, but not most of them. What did they think about God? Did they reject God? No. Maybe the true God, some of them did, which is just as serious. But they did. They weren't like raving atheists who said, we got to get rid of God and we don't need God at all. And part of it goes back to what you said earlier. We're going to talk about it in a minute. We're running out of time. But they didn't normally reject God. They didn't reject the idea of God. They were viewing him differently. And that's why you see even, okay, say our founding documents very much influenced by the Enlightenment in that period. But what do they still say? Our rights are endowed by our Creator. Okay, they didn't say Mother Earth or, you know, evolutionary theory. They said Creator, didn't they? They said Creator, okay? So they didn't reject God, but they saw him differently than how he truly is. And we're going to be out of time, but let me just introduce this word here. Deism. You see that there? You can see that there in the study guide. I've got it in italics. Deism. This idea of deism becomes very popular, and it's very Enlightenment. Okay, some of the American founding fathers were largely deist. Not most of them, though. That's another myth. I think I was just reading something. It might have even been in the study guide for our Exodus thing where he said, like, most of the founders were deists. That's not true. There were a few of the prominent ones that were, but you know, most of the founders were pretty orthodox in their Christian belief. A lot of the Anglicans, you know, and Congregationalists. But there were some who were very much, you know, would say they're deists. Jefferson is kind of an interesting guy because I've studied a little bit about him, but there's much more. That's one of those my heaven projects, you know, when I have eternity, I'm going to read more. But the religion of Jefferson is very interesting because you can read some stuff from Jefferson. It sounds wonderfully orthodox Christianity that Jefferson wrote. You go to the Jefferson Memorial, it's got some good quotes up there. I remember we went there years ago, and Shoshana was like, do they know this stuff's up here? You know, it's like in the Jefferson, you know, it would never happen today, probably. But 100 years ago, whenever they built it, they put it in there. So he's talking about God here, you know. It's like, you know, can we do that now? But then other things you read of his, it's like, yeah, that sounds pretty deist, you know. But I think Jefferson, as a thinker, he kind of wrestled with a lot of these things throughout his life. So it's kind of hard to pin down. And again, with anybody who wrote and said a lot of stuff, we talked about this with Luther and Jefferson, it said and wrote a lot of things. Their lifespan is, you know, you can read things at different points and what do they believe. I mean, I've read things where some historians have tried to argue basically after Jefferson was like completely a deist. There was a book came out years ago, kind of created a stir. Basically, the authors argued, well, he was really just a Christian, you know, in the end, you know. But it's kind of complex. But the point is, the deist here, and we'll close on this because we're out of time. We'll get into this a little bit more next week. They didn't reject God completely, right, as we talked about. But what did they view about God? Anybody know? God created the world. And he stepped back. That's it. And we won't get into it too much. But that was the view. And again, what hasn't entered the equation yet? You said earlier, evolution. So later, these people departing from the Bible, what do they get introduced? Well, we'll introduce evolution, then we don't even really need God anymore, right? But at this time, a vast majority of these Enlightenment folks, they believed in a creator God. Because again, they weren't dum-dums. They said, we're here. We got here somehow. But it was a God who was, you know, you might have heard the illustration, the watchmaker. You know, this is really a deist illustration. It's not as we use it for Christianity, but it's really deism actually more than Christianity. Is that, okay, you have a watch, and the watch works, and we know that there was a what? Because you have a watch, a watchmaker. But what did the watchmaker do? He created this watch, and then what happens once he creates it and everything's in working order? The watch just kind of does its thing. Now, maybe you have to change the batteries once in a while. Maybe you have to wind it back in those days. But if it's working, it does its thing, right? So this is kind of how they're viewing God, as like the watchmaker God. God put all this together for us. He set up some scientific rules of nature, and then, you know, does its own thing. Okay? Maybe he's got to intervene once in a while, but for the most part, you know, God's the great watchmaker in the sky, and he put all this together, and then we go on. So that's really deism. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit more next week because we're out of time. All right, any last-minute questions?
So they read the first chapter of Genesis and then
the rest. Well, not exactly, but yeah, but they're at least, you know, they're acknowledging, you know, God is a creator God, you know, at least got that, you know. Anyway, anything else? Some good questions and comments there. So I think we got through mostly that first paragraph there at least, but we'll finish up with deism next time, talk a little bit about human nature, and then we'll go on from there and we'll get into like some more stuff like the Great Awakening and things like that.